Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Thanksgiving with Judy Wicks, an author and activist who is leading a delegation at Standing Rock serving Thanksgiving dinner to those resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline. For 15 years, she has held an annual Native American Thanksgiving dinner that gives thanks for the many foods in our diet first cultivated by Native Americans. And today, she's cooking dinner for the Native American protesters and their supporters who have been attacked by dogs, pepper sprayed, shot with rubber bullets, and sprayed with water cannons in sub-zero temperatures, making a stand to defend their ancestral lands from what they call the Black Snake, an oil pipeline that will contribute to global warming and the future destruction of our planet. Then we will speak with George Lakoff, the Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of California at Berkeley and a founding senior fellow at the Rockridge Institute. We will discuss his article at Common Dreams, A Minority President Trump, Why the Polls Failed and What the Majority Can Do, and assess the reasons the Republicans have ended up in control of the country in spite of not winning the popular vote, as well as what people can do to fight back without just showcasing Trump in the limelight, but rather highlighting the majority's positive moral view in the frame of the majority's positive worldview. Then finally, as we head into a plutocratic future accelerated by Trump's election, we'll examine what can be done to reverse the oligarchical takeover of the world where just 85 families control half of the planet's wealth, a trend that resembles medieval duchies controlled by a few families and powerful multinational companies, with a shrunken middle class of professionals and a vast global underclass. Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net and author of The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation, joins us to discuss the movement away from concentrated global power in the hands of a few towards local control and cooperative engagement of, by, and for the many. And joining us now on this Thanksgiving is Judy Wicks, an author, activist, and entrepreneur from Philadelphia, who's best known as founder of the White Dog Cafe, a pioneer in the local food movement. For 15 years, she has held an annual Native American Thanksgiving dinner to which she invited leaders of the Lenape tribe, the first people of the region, and gave thanks for the many foods in our diet first cultivated by Native Americans. This Thanksgiving, Judy is leading a delegation at Standing Rock serving Thanksgiving dinner to those resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Judy Wicks.
Thank you, Ian.
And this is pretty ironic and sadly so that on Thanksgiving, the Native American people who are defending their ancestral lands should be met with such brutality, with pepper spray and dogs, and now subsequently water cannons, and even some protesters have been gravely injured. A young woman is likely to lose her arm because of a stun grenade. What's the mood there in North Dakota?
Well, there's a graveness about the assault, a horrific time here in terms of the reaction to the assault by the police on the peaceful unarmed protectors. And we're working hard to prepare a feast to offer to all the water protectors later today.
And can you describe the feast?
Yes, the turkey was actually first domesticated by Native people. And so we are featuring a turkey, and we have a chef here, Jeffrey Stanton from Massachusetts, who is roasting the turkeys on spits over fire. And so that's kind of our feature. And we're also cooking vegetables in cast iron pots over fire. And we're using vegetables primarily that were those first cultivated by Native people, which include squash and pumpkin and cranberry and tomato and potatoes and so on. That have become a main part of our diet. So this is, and thanks to Native people for their ancestors making these foods available and really saving the lives of the early settlers. And what ended up happening for the indigenous people, as you know, is that there was genocide and betrayal of their treaties for the next, 500 years after the settlers came here. So we're trying at this time to give back to Native people and to come in humbleness and respect for their work to protect Mother Earth here at Standing Rock.
Well, indeed, back in 1621, the settlers, of course, were essentially kicked out of England. Then they moved to Holland, where they were then kicked out and then eventually came back to the England. And then they were basically told to go to the New World, and they did. So those settlers were, as we know, you know, religious zealots, I suppose. But they were literally fed and rescued from starvation by the very people that who later they and the white settlers helped to exterminate to a large degree. So I take it, though, that the original Thanksgiving dinner was a sort of truce between the native peoples and these strange people coming with their Bibles.
Well, yes, but there's a lot of it's really a myth as far as we can tell. I mean, I'm not a historian, but it's my understanding that the idyllic setting of the pilgrims and the Native Americans sitting down to Thanksgiving dinner together is a myth. And some people actually believe that it was a day in which Native Americans were massacred in a village in Massachusetts. So there's a lot of sadness and anguish really associated with Thanksgiving for Native people. Yet, nevertheless, most Native people that we've run into here at Standing Rock, they do celebrate Thanksgiving as a family time, you know, as all Americans do. Where we give thanks as a family for our many blessings. We chose this day because of its iconic nature to authentically give back to Native Americans and to thank them and to stand here with them at Standing Rock in appreciation for their struggle to protect their land and their water and their way of life. You know, from the encroachment of the oil pipeline.
Well, isn't it our land and our water and our planet at the end of the day? My understanding is that this protest goes beyond just stopping this pipeline. It's intended also to stop what's going to be in the pipeline, which is oil that should be left in the ground.
That's absolutely true. That the big picture here is that this is really an epic battle between the forces of greed and power that the oil pipeline and the whole fossil fuel industry represents, that the Native people call the black snake, their prophecy said, would come across the country devouring everything. And that's what the fossil fuel companies are doing. They're devouring life on Earth, including the lives of our future children. And the battle here at Standing Rock represents the struggle to save planet Earth. You're correct in saying that you know if this it's not just that this oil might leak, but if they're successful in getting this oil to market, it will be the equivalent of 30 coal power plants burning for the next 20 or 25 years, putting all that carbon into the air. We don't have that time. This is an urgent situation to save our planet. And we need that they're spending $3.7 billion to put in this pipeline. And that money should instead, why are the banks loaning that money? They should be loaning the money to the solar installers, you know, to the wind turbine people. That this is, you know, we need to gather our forces just as we did during World War II to save our planet. Everything that we love and know is at stake here. And the Native Americans are taking the front line to help civilization survive.
Well, already apparently about 300 Native Americans and non-Native protesters have been injured, particularly in this long clash that just took place on Sunday evening, where 26 were taken to hospital with severe head and limb wounds, eye trauma, internal bleeding, hypothermia from being doused with a water cannon in 22-degree weather. And I mentioned the young woman who may lose her arm as a result of a stun grenade, which the authorities there, the police, are denying they fired. These things are not exactly available off the shelf, so I don't know where else it could have come from. This has prompted Frank Sanchez, a delegate from the Sioux tribe, to say in an interview at the Huffington Post that basically it's an act of war. And it does feel like the Native Americans are our front line in this war, war on the planet.
That's correct.
So what's your sense there amongst those that have come along with yourself to serve Thanksgiving dinner? Do you think this war will be won? It seems tragic that the very people who have suffered so much at the hands of the people, the white colonists who took over this country, should be protecting us. It's almost like it should be the other way around, surely.
Well, you know, and it historically, it was the Native Americans that helped the settlers survive. The settlers, as they came here, were totally incapable of fending for themselves because they didn't know how to grow the indigenous crops. So Native Americans taught the settlers how to cultivate these crops that they had learned to cultivate over thousands of years. So they really saved the early settlers. And now again, at this time in history, it's the Native Americans that are fighting for our survival, for the survival for everyone. And they even say to the police officers and to the pipeliners, we are fighting for your children too, not just our children. We're fighting for all children on this planet. We want to save Mother Earth and our water and our land for our children in the future.
Well, just to quote Frank Sanchez, the Sioux leader, I'm a prisoner of war in my own land. That's the only way I can see it. We have the right to hunt, fish, and gather as we always did, but all the barbed wire fences and posts to keep out have to come down so that we continue living the way we have always lived. So that, you know, that is the sort of, you recall the kind of frontier myth of don't fence me in. I mean, talk about fencing in people on their ancestral land. That's
right.
That's,
we saw the Native Media Center here has drones that go over the land so they can see what's going on, and they found that there was a whole herd of wild buffalo that were trapped against the barbed wire that's protecting the pipes, so that, and they were cut off from their source of water and food. So this is a horrendous scar on Mother Earth, and you know it's affecting not only the people but the wildlife.
So since you're feeding these protesters who've been protesting for a long time, and as we've mentioned, they've suffered injuries and tremendous hardship, starting out with guard dogs attacking them, pepper spray, etc., and now water cannon and tear gas. And what's the mood then in terms of determination? Because it does seem that the pipeline people and the Morton County sheriffs are determined. The Army Corps of Engineers is asking for a kind of pause to reconsider the route of this pipeline, but that doesn't seem to be stopping the pipeline company from pushing ahead as fast as they can. So is that what's happening here? That, you know, while we're told that the Obama administration is asking for a pause, the pipeline people aren't listening and they're trying to create facts on the ground?
Well, we're hoping that President Obama will stand up for what's happening here, because we're really depending on him to stop the violence against the Native water protectors and those who have come to support them. People are not going to quit here. This is a life and death struggle, and all of us, including myself, feel that we are here to protect all that we hold dear. We're here to protect Mother Earth, as well as to stand with the Native people. And there's a sense of commitment and resilience and determination here not to give up. So I just pray that there's not further violence.
Well, Judy Wicks, I thank you for joining us, and I thank you for what you are doing there at Standing Rock today, serving Thanksgiving dinners to those that are resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Judy Wicks, who's an author, activist, and entrepreneur from Philadelphia, who is best known as founder of the White Dog Cafe, a pioneer in the local food movement. For 15 years, she held an annual Native American Thanksgiving dinner to which she invited leaders of the Lenape tribe, the first people of the region, and gave thanks for the many foods in our diet first cultivated by Native Americans. This Thanksgiving, Judy is leading a delegation at Standing Rock where they are serving Thanksgiving dinner to those resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with George Lakoff about a minority President Trump, why the polls failed, and what the majority can do.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, and his latest book is The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. And he has an article at Common Dreams, A Minority President Trump, Why the Polls Failed and What the Majority Can Do. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
What a pleasure to be here, as always.
Well, thank you, George. And, of course, we have Thanksgiving, and a lot of people wondering what we have to be thankful for with this radical political shift underway, where an extreme right-wing government is now in charge of the government, the courts, and the country, even though Donald Trump lost by 2 million votes in the popular vote. But in terms of what the majority can do, let's start there, because people, we don't want to reinforce despair, and we want to give people some kind of direction, because this is a situation that obviously is intolerable and has to change.
Well, there are lots of things that a majority of Americans can do. I've been thinking about some of them. There's a lot more, I'm sure. So the first thing to understand is that we will have a minority president. A president that, from the point of view of the majority, is a loser. And don't let him forget it. You know, keep calling him the minority president. And, you know, he's a man who says he's got to win, 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 win. The worst thing that he can think of himself as is a loser. So keep pointing out that he's a loser. I mean, that's the negative part. But I think the major thing is the positive part. Americans have to actually get out American values and make sure that they're out there clear and have a system of communication in which they can do this. And that's a serious undertaking. It's not impossible. It can be done. It's not even that expensive. But the main thing is that you have to understand certain things about how the mind and brain work. And that's the thing that is important here. Trump, after 50 years as a super salesman, intuitively understood this. But right now, he is kind of becoming a dictator of the country, and that's not very good.
Well, the paradox with Trump, though, is that he's the boy from Queens who was never quite accepted by the New York elite, and he got so upset, for example, over the cast of Hamilton addressing the vice president. And it's a strange thing that this is a man who wants to be loved after running a campaign based on hate. I mean, he berated all of the news executives and the New York Times executives and reporters, and basically tells them that they're not printing the truth. And the truth is his truth, which all of which is public relations. He just wants the press, like the press in Russia, to adore Putin, and like the press in Hungary to adore Erdogan.
It's not merely adoration, and I think that's important. Yeah, okay, it's adoration, for sure, but it's actually adoration with a political purpose, and people keep forgetting what his political purpose is, and it's a major one, and it's the same political purpose we see in Putin and in various other people around the world. Conservatism is fundamentally about strict father morality. And the opposite to that is a nurturant morality. So what you have in progressive thought is a basic idea that people, you know, citizens care about other citizens. And how do they express that care? They work through their government to provide public resources for everybody that, you know, maximizes their freedom. And those resources can be in public health and public education, but also in things for business, that are both for public life and private life, like roads and bridges and airports and, you know, all the things we have, and science and, you know, all of the work in all of the computer industry all came from government research, government-sponsored research, as did the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, this is something where, you know, those public resources are necessary and important if you care about other citizens and they make your life free. You know, if you're sick and you don't have health care, you're not free if you get cancer or if you break your leg. I mean, it's just, that's how it is. If you're not educated, you're not free. And this is something that the progressives have never really gotten out there. I think every progressive believes it, but they don't say it, and they haven't said it. And there are many other things they haven't said. For example, what is a regulation? A regulation is a form of protection. Why do we have regulations? They're to keep corporations from poisoning people, poisoning the environment, cheating people, cheating stock investors, and so on. That's what regulations are about. That's what they're there. They're protections. Call them protections. When Trump gets up and says, we're going to get rid of regulations, you know, for every new regulation, we're going to have get rid of two old ones. Well, he's going to have to say, for every two protections, we get rid of two older protections. That's not going to fly if you tell people the truth. And that's the problem. You need to name it correctly. There are many things that you can do along that line, and we can get into them. But importantly, we have to understand that language matters, that communication matters, and that understanding how the brain works matter. If you're a conservative, what do you believe? What strict father morality says in a family is that, and it's a family that Trump was raised in, by the way, it says that the father is in charge. That his, you know, what he says goes, that his world, what he says is right and wrong, is right and wrong. And if you don't obey him and respect him, you're going to get punished severely. You're going to get smacked, and if you want to avoid the punishment, you have to discipline yourself. That is, not do just what feels good, but to do what the father says is right. And what that means is, in the strict father family, you don't have unconditional love. It's conditional love. And that's very important, and those are the conditions. What follows from that is really important. The justification for the father's having authority in the family is that the father knows what's right and what's right and wrong. And that from that follows something very important about authority in this worldview. It says that it is a matter of nature that the people who are more moral have won. So you have God, that gives you a moral hierarchy. If you look at people who have won out, so according to, you know, rules of nature or God, if you take it to be God. So you have God above man, man above nature. We've conquered nature. Nature is there for you to do what you want with it. It's the rich above the poor. They've been disciplined and they've deserved it. The strong above the weak. Employers above employees. All of that in that hierarchy. Adults above children. In 21 states, teachers and coaches are allowed to hit children with sticks who don't show sufficient respect for them, or talk back. Western culture above non-Western culture, America above other countries, and so on. Those are conservative views, and they're not just with Trump. They've, you know, been there in conservatism throughout and grown in the last 20 years. Now, You then go further than that, the bigotry hierarchy, where you have men above women, whites above non-whites, Christians above non-Christians, straights above gays. And when you put that together, what you have is a view of conservatism that has been in conservative ideology for some time. Now, that is what Trump is pushing. And that is the worldview that Trump enters into and has. And that means that he, as the ultimate strict father in the world, is supposed to be obeyed, period. And what he says is right is right. And if the news media don't agree with that, they're lying. That just follows from his worldview and the worldview that he and many other Republicans want to press on the world. Now, what's interesting is that not all Republicans or not all conservatives are only have this worldview. They have it as a major worldview, but there's a minor one. There are what are called moderate conservatives, just as there are moderate progressives. A moderate progressive is someone who is mostly progressive, but has some conservative views, maybe on business, maybe in certain other parts of life. Moderate conservative is someone who has mainly these strict father views, but, you know, some nurturing views about some areas of life. And then there is a very interesting phenomenon among conservatives, and you see it a lot in just about every part of conservative life. There's what is called in-group care. You take care of the people in your in-group. So in churches, in evangelical right-wing churches, they take care of people in the church. So, you go to church and there'll be people to babysit for you, to give you financial advice. And if you're poor and been going to church a long time and have a job, but you're not making it and losing your home, they might build a house for you. This is part of in-group nurturance. It's there in the military. On military bases, you have education, housing, cheap goods, et cetera, providing for military families. And in a platoon, you don't leave your brothers behind if they're wounded. I mean, it's in-group nurturance a lot, and it's shown all over the place. And maybe only in one's family, but it's there. And it's very important to see that though you have a major conservative view, the strict father view with a moral hierarchy, that moral hierarchy determines what the right wing has been trying to pass in legislation, even if they're only largely conservative but partly progressive, they'll still go along with most of those views. Trump is going along with most of those views, and by having Reince Priebus in the White House, helping to set up this administration, you're going to have at least some people, being major. You're going to have all of them be having most of those views, but not necessarily all. And that's going to be an interesting thing. So that is part of what we have to face. We have somebody who who has probably all of these views, and who wants to impose these views on the public and the world.
Well, when you talk about government regulations and the need for a counter-narrative saying that these are protections for the people, nothing, I think, is more stark than the fact that one of the reasons why Donald Trump won the white working class in the Rust Belt, because they bought into Trump's narrative that their jobs loss and downsizing was a result of unions, immigrants, and government regulations. And meanwhile, on the Democratic side, all they heard from the Democrats, if they heard anything at all from Hillary Clinton, was that, oh, this is just to do with the end of the industrial age and the taking over of the information age. You know, this is this sort of techno-babble explanation, which is so clearly inadequate. So to my mind, that's a perfect example of what you're saying.
Well, in addition to that, the Democrats blew it. And so did the pollsters. And this is very important. What you had on the Democratic side was, first, facts. Facts, 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 not values, values, values. You know, on the right wing side, you had values, values, values. you know, and that's, you know, a major difference. Trump understood the values of the people he was talking to, and he knew how to talk to them, and he also knew how to change brains, and we can get to that in a while. But the main thing is, you know, he didn't just say, in fact, there weren't any facts, you know, facts didn't matter. He understood that values were what mattered. That, so the first thing is, the facts without the values aren't there. Secondly, what's really crucial in all of this is understanding the first thing you learn, you know, about the mind when you're studying cognitive science and neuroscience, which is most thought is unconscious. You know, some people say it's only, you know, 60 or 70%. Some people say it's as much as 98%. But it's mostly unconscious. And you see this, you know, it shows up in fMRIs. You can tell it there. It shows up in all kinds of experiments. You can show over and over, most thought is unconscious. Now, then the question is, well, what is that unconscious thought like? And what we've been able to show is that it has to do with things like conceptual frames, conceptual metaphors, and, you know, discourse, that is, narratives, emotions, things like that, which are very important and that shape the way you reason, what real human reason is. Reason is not just mathematical logic. As Descartes said, it's, you know, it really, there is a logic that follows from an understanding that uses frames, that uses metaphors, that uses all sorts of other narrative structures through which you understand everything. The second thing that you learn in, you know, in the first day of any such course is that ideas don't float in the air. Ideas do not float in the air. They are carried out by neural circuitry. They're physical. And what that means is that you have to understand that, that every single idea or ideology, which is a cluster of ideas, is a complex neural circuit. That neural circuit, when fixed, it characterizes what you can and cannot understand. So what happens is that if you have an ideology or a view of the world, unconscious or conscious, doesn't matter, but basically an unconscious one, which is most of what it is, what you're going to do is understand everything in terms of that view of the world. That means if your neural system doesn't allow you to understand a fact that comes in, what will happen? You'll either not notice it or be puzzled by it or ignore it or reject it. Or attack it, or make fun of it. I mean, that's what happens, you know, there. And it's not just a right-wing thing. Yes, it's true in science denial and all of those things, but it's also true on the left. You know, the idea that people who are who voted for Trump and who are strongly believe in most of those ideas actually have a moral view of what is right that is different from you know, a progressive view of what is right, is just, you know, it's not believed, it's not understood. They say, who are these people? They must be uneducated, you know. Well, they're not necessarily any more uneducated than anybody else. They didn't, they may or may not have gone to college, you know, the working white folks, you know, et cetera. But there are a lot of people who are very well educated who voted that way. So, for example, you have the demography of, you know, suburban women who are educated, as if they're necessarily going to vote for Hillary. No, they aren't necessarily going to vote for Hillary. And, you know, because they had some of these values.
And one, by the way, George, 1 in 3 Latinos voted for Trump, even though he insulted the entire Hispanic race.
Now, let me explain why this is, and it's extremely important. A lot of Latinos have a strict, came from countries where they're brought up with a strict father culture. You know, it's not uncommon among Latinos, you know, to have a strict father culture. Now, what does that mean? It means that you have this understanding of what is right and what is wrong, how people should live. Right? Now, that is a moral understanding. What does a moral, your moral understanding have to do with your identity? Everything. You know, you want to think of yourself as a moral person, as a person who does what's right. If you have a strict father view of the world as your moral system, then that is what's right, and that is where your identity is centered. So if something is going wrong with that happening, you know, if you are in the white working class and you have a strict father view of the world and you think that you should be above everybody else or be in charge of your life and, you know, and have respect from everybody and so on, and then it turns out that you don't have a job and you have, you know, crummy working conditions and your family can barely make ends meet, then what's happening is you don't have self-respect. Your very identity is being threatened. And Democrats didn't understand that.
Well, it does seem, though, that the white working class, I think it's certainly in my mind, George Lakoff, a safe bet that Donald Trump doesn't care about anybody but himself. And there's no indication in his record that he does. Do you think that the white working class who voted for him, along with one in three Latinos, et cetera, will be seduced and abandoned? Because one of the ironies is the top priority of this new Republican Congress coming in is to get rid of Obama's new rule that overtime workers earning under $47,000 a year have to be paid time and a half in overtime. And that's so here you have the working class voting for this guy. The first priority of the Republican Congress is to screw them.
That's correct, of course, because that isn't what this was about. This is about imposing a worldview. And in that worldview, the working the white working class worker is not very high. The white working class worldview is not the rich above the poor. It's not the employer above the employee. I mean, that's a very important part. The white working class worker is not at the top of this hierarchy at all. And that's not, you know, it's very important to understand that was never part of the plan. It was just a way to get votes.
Well, in closing, George Lakoff, on this Thanksgiving, what is your final sense in terms of making listeners recognize that they've got a job to do?
I think the first thing is to understand what's going on, to understand what the conservative and progressive worldviews really are, to understand that you have a majority, that and that if that majority just says the things it said before, let me give you an issue here. First, there's the question of the president calling for new messaging. But he has the idea that the messaging is just slogans. Messaging isn't slogans. Messaging is how one thinks, how people, how their brains change. That's what's going on here. You have to ask what is going on in people's brains, not what are the words. And, you know, the words matter for what's going on in people's brains, but it's not just a message. There is a lot more than that, and you also have the way to get that message out there. Secondly, the press is compromised. When Trump called in the major people from the press and said, I don't need you, you know, what he's saying is I can get Breitbart to make propaganda tapes every day, and that is what is going to go on. And not only that, we've caught you. Why? Because you guys put me on every day during the nomination and presidential race. I dominated the airwaves. Why? Because you could make more money that way, because you got higher ratings, and I gave you higher ratings. Now you're caught, you know. I don't want you to be questioning me and embarrassing me or anything like that, or saying things I don't believe. So I'm going to tell you and set out, you know, on TV what I believe, and you're going to have to report it because your duty is to report what the president says. So he's caught them. And the question is, how does the press get out of this? It's not just by showing he's wrong, because when you negate things, remember, the book, Don't Think of an Elephant. You start thinking of an elephant. If you say, Trump said this, and it's false for this reason, you still get Trump said this in your brain. Right. You know, you don't do it by just negating what Trump says. What you need to do is positively say what has to be said. And that takes discipline. It takes understanding what has to be said, understanding what not to say, understanding how to get those ideas across, and so on. Those are, that's what serious communication is, and serious work in the press goes along with that. That is, you do your investigative reporting positively as well as negatively.
Well, George Lakoff, I thank you for joining us on this Thanksgiving. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
Thank you,
George.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with George Lakoff, who is professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, and his latest book is the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant. And he has an article at Common Dreams of Minority President Trump, Why the Polls Failed and What the Majority Can Do. We're going to take a brief station break and be back on this Thanksgiving examining what can be done to reverse the oligarchical takeover of the world.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Well, I'm gonna tell you fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And on this Thanksgiving Day, we're joined by Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories of Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication schwartzreport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. And his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Welcome to you, Ian, and I hope you're having a wonderful Thanksgiving.
I am, notwithstanding the political change that just took place in the United States, where Donald Trump appears to have looked upon the American government as an acquisition. How does it strike you?
It strikes me very much the same way. I think we have, you're beginning to hear about the rather obscure Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, emoluments part of the Constitution, which I haven't heard anybody talk about in about 100 years, but which was extremely important to the founders, who, of course, had direct experience with what a corrupt administration was like. I find Trump two things. One is a master of manipulating the media. For instance, he's got them all off on the New York Times thing, you know, the meetings on, the meetings off. And the effect that had was to obfuscate the much deeper and much more fundamental issue is that we've elected a president who isn't so much a president as an emperor in the way that Louis XIV was the king of France. I mean, the conflicts of interest are so astonishing, and the idea that he's going to liquidate his business empire, I think, is absurd. His argument, oh, well, everybody knew that, but of course everybody didn't really think, and the media was so inept that they didn't really get into the incredible conflicts of interest that exist and that are going to exist, as far as I can see, for the next 4 years. We've never had anything quite like this in the United States.
But can you make the case that the election of Trump, because I recall he said on the stump how much he loves the undereducated, that this was a vote for Trump, was the undereducated voting for Trump and the educated voting for Hillary Clinton. I think the statistics bear that out. She, needless to say, has now passed the 2 million point in the popular vote, being ahead of Trump, and she may end up being at 2.5 to 3 million ahead by the end of the counting.
Yeah.
So we have this extraordinary situation where the emperor and the oligarchs like the Koch brothers and this new oligarch as the head of education, Betsy DeVos, it's almost as if unwittingly the white working class in this country have rewarded the oligarchs who are going to continue to dumb them down so that the people in America more and more will be voting for the interests of the oligarchs against their own interests.
Yes, I think that's very true. I just, I think the thing that we're not talking about is that it isn't that the Democratic elites don't understand the flyover part of America. I think it's that the flyover part of America has become so ignorant of the actual issues, and this arises in large measure because of the capture of Christianity by a kind of theocratic rightist fundamentalism. That the difficulty is that these people that voted for Trump do not recognize that he is not going to advance their interests. The coal mines are not coming back. The the steel industry is not coming back. That we are moving, whether the United States is moving, the rest of the world is moving out of the carbon energy era. India has now made a commitment they want to be entirely non-carbon by 2030. Much of Europe, France, Holland, Scandinavian countries are talking about having all electric vehicles on their roads and, in fact, passing laws about this by 2030, 2035. That's only 14 years, 20 years away. The one bright spot is that we are going to go out of the carbon energy era willy-nilly, whether the United States oil interests and other oil interests continue to push this. So I think that is positive news and ought to be a cause for celebration and Thanksgiving. I really see this vote as a decision by a significant percentage of the American electorate, not the majority, and as you pointed out, but a significant percentage that is essentially responding to the four major trends that I think are shaping the world today. And very few people are talking about them. You see little bits and pieces, but the four trends that I think are really important and I think we should consider very seriously at Thanksgiving are that for the first time in 500 years, being born white will not confer privilege. That's the first one. The second one is that for the first time in living memory and way beyond, actually probably more than thousands of years, being born white and male will not confer dominance. The third is that Western Caucasian cultural values are not going to run the world. And the fourth is that we are seeing the rise of neo-feudalism in the transfer of power from nation states to multinational corporations, which essentially are going to function like baronies and duchies in the medieval period, and that what we're going to end up with is a tiny group of people who own most of the wealth. Right now, 10% of the world owns 89% of all the world's wealth, and a modest middle class made up mostly of professional people, lawyers, doctors, engineers, and then a huge peasantry that are deliberately kept ignorant and pliable, and for whom easy non-fact-based beliefs will be emphasized. That I think is the major problem. Is not that the flyover Americans weren't heard; it's that they do not realize the forces that are at work that are negatively affecting their own lives.
Well, apropos the education issue that we were just talking about, isn't it true that the governor of Michigan, where Betsy DeVos comes from...
Exactly.
What did he argue in the test meeting the other day?
It's mind-boggling. Yes, Governor Rick Schneider, governor of Michigan, is basically arguing in court that children do not have a fundamental right to literacy. That's what his attorneys are saying. There's a lawsuit that's pending. About 47% of the Detroit children are either illiterate or semi-literate. And so their lawsuits in the public about the public schools not really teaching kids to proper literacy. And the argument that his attorneys are making in the court are that there is no fundamental right to being literate, and that the government has no fundamental responsibility for educating children. It's precisely the opposite of what all of America has had as a fundamental tradition for hundreds of years.
Well, on the other point that you just made, though, about a new kind of global medieval kind of duchies of oligarchs and multinational corporations ruling the world with a very small professional middle class and then a vast underclass globally, that does seem to be a real trend. But the more alarming statistic is that Oxfam reported recently that half of the world's wealth is controlled by only 85 families.
Yes, that's right. That's what that's the point I'm making. I mean, we are, you know, in the medieval period, the peasantry was land-based because wealth was principally land-based at that time. And so wealthy people owned large tracts of land, and the peasantry either owned just little strips in their villages and where they could grow garden stuff, but they worked as villeins for their lords. Well, we don't have that. That's not the kind of wealth we have now. This is a different thing. But what we are creating is a large underclass of people who may at best own a car and maybe a modest house. I mean, 62% of Americans don't have have $1,000 or less in savings. So we have a huge number of people who have very, very little assets, and a very tiny group of people who control as I said, 10% of the population of the world owns 89% of the wealth. And if you break it down to the 1%, it gets even more distorted, so that you have a few people. I mean, I just read a paper that proposed that eventually most of the world's assets will be owned by about 4,000 people, and everybody else will sort of either be in service to that or will just be this part of this underclass. And you don't see anybody in the media talking about this.
Well, let's see what we can do or what people can do on this Thanksgiving to reverse that. Obviously, it's a massive task. However, I just learned recently, for example, when you mentioned that the jobs in steel are not going to come back to Youngstown, back during the Carter administration, the writing was on the wall about the erosion of the industrial base of the United States. And there was an effort underway to create worker-owned cooperatives like the Spanish Madragon Cooperative.
Yes.
In Youngstown. In other words, the workers could take over the steel plants, and of course the steel companies weighed in against Carter. But there seems to be across the board real possibilities and some very, very optimistic examples of rural state banks, for example, lots of co-ops, worker-owned industries and co-ops developing. That seems to me to be, particularly with the Spanish example being so extraordinary, that seems to be a possible way to fight against this oligarchical trend.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, Ian. I mean, as I look at it, I think what we're going to see is a transfer from the federal level down to the local level, not even the state level, although maybe in some cases. I mean, for one thing, if you've noticed, I'm sure you have, the secession movement, I don't think it's going to succeed, but as an expression of social intention, the Washington, Oregon, California drive to because these cultures are prospering much more than the red value states. I mean, if you look at comparisons between red value states and blue value states, you can see without exception that the blue value states always do better. And the reason is, and I've been looking at this now for 16 years, and I guess this is the good news of Thanksgiving, is that social programs which are designed with their first priority being the increase of well-being inevitably are cheaper, more efficient, more effective, easier to implement, more productive, nicer to live under, and longer lasting than social programs which are designed to enrich just small groups and which produce a decrease or degradation in well-being, and that the way you create well-being is at the local, individual and local level. I mean, I wrote the 8 Laws of Change specifically in anticipation of this election because I saw these trends occurring, and as dark as it may seem, maybe on Thanksgiving it would be a good thing to focus on the fact that there is no power on earth more powerful than collective human intention. When a mass of people hold to a nonviolent, wellness-oriented program, whether it's civil rights or exploitation of resources or anything else, inevitably, because well-being is the first priority, you do better. And if you look across not only between states like Sam Brownback's Kansas and Jerry Brown's California, or you look at between countries like Norway and Russia, for instance, you can see very clearly that where well-being and local activity is the focus, that you get a much better, cheaper, more efficient, more productive outcome. And so I hope that everybody, as they give thanks on Thanksgiving, will make a commitment to that from the say this Thanksgiving forward, that every choice they make, the toilet paper they buy, the breakfast cereal they buy, that they will always make a point of choosing that option which is the most life-affirming and compassionate. And if we do that, we will be able to right our ship and to produce a more wellness-oriented future, because the alternative is very bleak indeed.
Well, indeed, don't buy brawny paper products, because you're enriching the Koch brothers. I thank you for joining us, Stephen Schwartz, on this Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. A pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories of Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. And his latest book is The 8 Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.